Welcome to the NOLA Drink Show. Join us as we explore the world of drink, food, and culture in New Orleans and beyond. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody. Hey, thanks for listening to the show. Friends, I do appreciate it. As always, Brian Diaz here with you on the NOLA Drink Show. Hey, friends, if you are listening here on the radio in the greater New Orleans area, obviously here in the United States, today is Veterans Day, and I want to send out our sincerest thanks to all of you out there who have served and to your loved ones who also sacrificed with your service. I hope this country can find a path that does justice and honors your commitment to this country. We need a place of equality, of justice, inclusion, a healthy environment, quality education, so many other things. We owe you a debt of gratitude for your service, and we owe you a better country that lives up to that sacrifice and those commitments that you and your loved ones have made. Friends, got a really good show here for you this week. Really excited about this one. Our featured interview and our guest on our featured interview is Dr. Jessica Harris. Dr. Harris is an historian who largely specializes in culinary history, but several other things as well. And she also focuses often on the African diaspora, talking about foodways, the African influence on our culinary traditions, culinary technology, our overall history. As we know, obviously, Africa has many, many, many distinct cultures, and the contributions to how we eat and to our cultural history and our history in general cannot be overstated. And Dr. Harris is a wonderful source of knowledge and information on this array, on this array, of subjects. Pleased to be chatting with her. We will head over to the Historic New Orleans Collection, to their research facility located on Charter Street in the French Quarter, 400 block. Their holdings are amazingly impressive. Do go visit the Historic New Orleans Collection. If you're living in New Orleans and haven't been there, as I always say, shame on you. I think I say that later in the interview. And if you're coming to visit, as we also discuss in the interview, it is a place that you want to visit to teach you about New Orleans. I always tell people when you come, go there, check it out, start your vacation, go there first, the Historic New Orleans Collection. Go to their public areas on Royal Street and see the various exhibits and displays that they have. They have the new Saint Ray Brulator House, which opened up somewhat recently, and a wonderful, wonderful museum, free to enter. It is a great way. Come there first, go check it out, do some exploration, and then go out and check out New Orleans. And as we discuss, I think you'll see things with a different set of eyes than what you would perhaps see otherwise. Got a great show coming up for you next week, friends. We will be over at the newly opened Sazerac House, visiting. It's a pretty interesting place. A lot of high-tech stuff going on there. And, of course, you can sample some of the different things in the New Orleans collection, Sazerac Rye, Cane Rum, all kinds of stuff. So you can go check that out. And they're open now, and we'll be there visiting with them. And we'll just get, I think, probably talk about the space, of course. I think we'll talk a little bit about the history of Sazerac rye, talk about the history of rye and bourbon, the extraordinary influence that that has had on the drinking culture in New Orleans and, of course, in the United States. So we're looking forward to that visit there. And that'll be the show next week, as I mentioned, friends. So, hey, be sure to tune in for that one. Yeah, we're going to bounce over to the Historic New Orleans Collection here in just a second after the break for our featured interview with Dr. Jessica Harris. Take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show, friends. Come on back.
Every afternoon when I wake up, I say a little prayer and drink up, and thank the Lord for driving me home once more. There's an open Bible, Lord.
All right, everybody. everybody. Welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks for listening into the show, friends, as always. And yes, as promised, a very special guest with us here today, talking with historian Dr. Jessica Harris. Jessica, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Honored to be here.
Oh, thank you for making time. I really appreciate it. And we were talking before we went on the air, you split your time between Martha's Vineyard and down here in New Orleans. And you just...
And New York.
Yeah, oh, and New York. I don't want to forget
that. Gotta give the apple a little time.
Okay, can't give them short shrift. Fair enough. So welcome back to town, because you just got here.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Now, this is the first fall venture, so this is good.
No, and you brought the good weather with you, so I thank you for
weather
that.
Weather has been splendid.
Well, great. So you were down here principally this trip to do a food symposium with the Historic New Orleans Collection, our good friends who are making this all happen here today. And let's start there. Let's talk a little bit about how that went. It was focused on one of my favorite topics, wine.
Yeah. No, well, I think it started about a decade ago, actually. And at that point in time, let's see, Katrina was 14 years ago at this point.
2005, yeah.
Yeah, so it was a little, well, my tenure down here. I was here long before, but I, before Katrina, I like to call that BK.
BK.
Yeah, BK. So I was committed before everybody else. It was BK. But I had become the inaugural scholar and the Ray Charles Chair at Dillard University. And I was, just because I am someone who by nature likes to partner with people, looking for partnerships, and came to the Historic New Orleans Collection, and they received me wonderfully, and thought, let's talk about maybe doing a food thing that would look at the food of New Orleans. And my special kind of thing is connections. And so the idea was to look at the food of New Orleans and talk about the culinary connections. One of the things about New Orleans is everybody here goes, oh, it's so unique. There's nowhere else quite like this place. It's, you know, we are so unique. But that's just because we're looking north. If we look south, there are an awful lot of places that are not this place, that are pretty much like this place, but that come out of the same kind of cultural history. And so the idea was to try to connect New Orleans with not just the American South or the United States, but with the world. And so that was what we started. So about, I guess, maybe a decade ago, we started doing Food Forum, or what, culinary symposia, if you want to be fancy about it.
Sounds good.
We've been talking about iconic New Orleans dishes or iconic New Orleans food ideas, and then connecting them with the world. So the first one that we did was rice and beans. And we did rice and beans. It was kind of an international conference. We actually brought up, well, didn't bring up because she lived in the States, but had a Cuban ethnographer, culinary ethnographer, Maricel Precia, who talked about rice and beans in Cuba. And I'm always grateful to her because she is the one who, you know, sort of informed me about the line of bean demarcation in Cuba. Everybody thinks of Cuban black beans, you know, sopa de habichuela negras,
sure,
and all of that.
Yeah.
But there is a line of bean demarcation in Cuba. In Oriente, they eat red beans, which connects them absolutely straight up here.
Right.
So it kind of goes Haiti, Oriente, Santiago, and all of that, and then into New Orleans. So she spoke about that and other things. We had Patricia Wilson, who at that point was at Johnson & Wales, and she was actually raised in Puerto Rico and was telling us about Puerto Rican beans and rice and how that worked. We had John Martin Taylor, whose nickname is Hoppin' John, who was probably one of, not probably, who was and is the preeminent culinary historian of low country food. He's certainly one of the people who started it. He's not necessarily a specialist in Geechee Gullah food particularly, but generally speaking, the food of the Carolina low country. And so he talked about black-eyed peas and rice, Hoppin' John, and you know, the various different kinds of peas that went into that. We had Donald Link, who talked about sausages and sausage making. We had Susan Spicer, who talked about making red beans and rice with Buster Holmes at the Monton Jazz Festival in France. And I think we had Leah Chase that year. I'm not sure if it was that year or another year, but she has spoken for us. We had Daphne Durbin, who talked about hot sauce. So we had a quite a range of, you know, culinary notables both restaurateurs and historians and so on and so forth. So that was, we were off to a good start.
That's great. So, and again, to reiterate what you said, the idea is to make connections with New Orleans and the rest of the world.
Right.
And Beans and Rice is a great place
Beans
to start.
Beans and Rice was a good place to start.
Now, you have such an interesting background, and I don't want to spend too much time on this because we got lots to talk about, but I was reading up on your biography. You spent time, you did theater criticism mm-hmm. and book reviews.
Oh,
and
yeah. I've been all over the map.
You've been all over the map.
I tell people I'm spread so thinly you can read through me.
So what inspired you then to get, because I noted that you were said introduced you as an historian at the top, and a culinary historian I think is probably fair. I don't want to limit that.
I think that's what people say. I mean, it's one of those, by training and background, my undergraduate degree is in French. I have a licence ès lettres from the Université de Nancy in Nancy, France.
Mm-hmm.
I have a master's from Queen's College, equally in French, on Le Renouveau de Don Juan de Molière sur la scène contemporaine, and a doctorate in theater, performance studies from NYU, where my dissertation was on the French-speaking theater of Senegal.
Okay. Oh. Mm-hmm.
So that's one side mm-hmm. of the mm-hmm. equation. But and I've taught, or I did teach, because I retired last summer after 50 years of teaching at Queens College in New York City. So, but I taught, I started out teaching English, and then while I was doing that, kind of just fell into a parallel career, if you will, as a journalist. So I was the travel editor for Essence in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I hate that it was that far back, but it was. So there that is. But, and one of the things that happened was, as I traveled, I began to, well, you have to eat. So I began to write about food and travel. I think I was probably one of the early women, and certainly one of the early black women to do that. And then gradually, because I was going to places within and that spawned, if you will, the African diaspora, although we didn't necessarily call it that back then, I was tasting basically a culinary continuum. And, you know, my mouth started talking to me and telling me, you know, that tastes like something you may have had last month or 2 months ago or, you know, 6 months ago or whatever. And so after my doctorate, I did a cookbook that was based on peppers and chilies. And why did I do a cookbook? Basically because I had an agent, and she said, what would you like to do? And I said, oh, maybe a cookbook. I like to cook, and, you know.
I was just going to say, you were always comfortable in the kitchen and always cooked.
Okay. I've always cooked. I'm not a professional chef, and people who are chefs, I have a girlfriend who says, you're a one-knife cook. It's like, yeah, and it's a paring knife, you know. But I haven't killed anybody, so nobody's complained. So
all digits are still in place?
Digits are still in place, so I'm doing okay. But so...
Then you kind of came into it from the angle of using food, food tradition, food ways to tell a story.
Not at all. What happened was I got a contract to write a cookbook, and it was going to be a book made about foods made with peppers and chilies from around the world. And then the academic kicked in. So I started reading Columbus's diaries and Marco Polo's reports and looking at the places where the chilies may have come from, may have been, or were consumed, and ended up doing a book that was not really a cookbook, but that had recipes. So it had recipes that was divided geographically, and it talked about different pepper uses in different places, but I also... Mm-hmm. sort of established a glossary, what were these peppers, some of them misnamed, you know, lo these, you know, 30 plus years afterwards, it's like, ooh, I called it that, it wasn't, you know,
right.
But, you know, when you write, you know that 3 minutes after it's printed, there's always something you want to recant.
Sure.
So that was the first one, and then there was a book that I wanted to write, and because the first one at least sold enough to... earn out its advance, which...
That's always a good thing in the book world,
was
right?
A good thing in the book world, but they let me do a second
one.
Yeah,
right.
So the second one was a book that came out as Iron Pots and Wooden Spoons, Africa's Gifts to New World Cooking. And that kind of was the one that focused what has now become the work, in that it sort of established a culinary continuum between the African continent and the hemisphere, and then looked at some of the spots on that continuum and talked about it in terms of food. And again, the same methodology. That was the one I probably read the Columbus Diaries for.
Okay,
and,
sure.
You know, seeing things of that sort, and then looking at just, you know, what those things were and how they ebbed and flowed.
That's really interesting. And I have several questions that I wanted to ask you. I'm just a little time check here. We're doing great. When we talk about, let's do this. Let me ask you, what is a food way? And then maybe you'll answer that question, then we'll take a little break and we'll come back and we'll get into some more stuff.
Okay, well, I think it's a term that was much used that I think is now kind of fallen into, everybody sort of, you know, rolls eyes and goes, yeah, food ways, we know you people.
Yeah.
But I think that what it does or what it was attempting to do was to expand simply beyond food, to include food and drink and manner of consumption and vessels with which consumed in some point, you know, so plates and dishes, everything from the actual agricultural and the botany, perhaps, all the way through to the decorative arts aspect, all encompassed within that idea of foodways.
Mm-hmm. So traditions, history, mannerisms.
That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Okay, fair enough. That's great. So when we talk about foodways with African-American culture, and feel free to use New Orleans if you want or not, what are some of the things that would make that different in how we describe it, or maybe even how we understand it? Let me phrase the question a different way. Is it fair to say because of the nature of African-American history in the United States and in this hemisphere in general that it obfuscates some of the reality of what the contributions are specifically?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I mean, I think that part of the sticky wicket, if you will, about African-Americans in hemispheric generality is enslavement. And it is the reason that there has been such an impact by African-Americans on the food of the hemisphere.
Mm-hmm.
Because the bottom line is we were at the bottom of the food chain, so we grew it. We had to grow it. It wasn't as though it was a choice and it's like, oh, I really want to go into those fields and grow rice for other people.
Mm-hmm.
It was forced labor, a forced unpaid labor. So in that sense, at being at the bottom of that food chain, you have or one has control in another kind of way. It's strange, but people relinquish control without realizing that they have relinquished it, so that the manner and the planting and the agricultural know-how that produced the rice that made Carolina's fortune, South Carolina particularly, well, South Carolina's fortune, and to some degree after South Carolina, Louisiana, was African know-how. And there are still discussions about whether or not it was actually African rice, although they talk about seed from Madagascar, which is a part of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
There is also a native African rice that we never think of. I always thought of rice as being from Asia.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a native African rice, Oryza glabirima, as opposed to Oryza sativa.
Okay.
So that know-how came. That know-how came in the heads and hands and hearts of the people who were enslaved out of the rice-growing regions of Africa. And they used that when they got here. And that's what created that wealth.
Okay.
So there are all kinds of parallels like that that we don't know. I'm actually the lead curator for a show at the Museum of Food and Drink in New York that's going to be opening at the end of February 2020 that is called African/American, The Making of a Nation's Table.
Oh, great.
And so it's going to look at those contributions of Africans in diaspora to the American table.
Jessica, let's do this. Let's take a brief break. We're going to come back and continue our conversation, okay?
Okay.
Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. Come on back. Everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Casey with you. Thanks for listening to the NOLA Drink Show, friends. This week, as always, pleased to be chatting with our guest, Dr. Jessica Harris. And Jessica, we were talking a little bit about the African diaspora and some of the experience, the dynamics with African Americans through enslavement, and maybe this was my question, how it might hide or make some of the contributions less obvious to the culinary history and tradition and culture. And again, feel free to use New Orleans or not, or the Western Hemisphere. What would be some, maybe perhaps a little bit simple, but what would be some examples of things that are those contributions, either technology, food, you mentioned rice, so some of the foodstuffs themselves, or techniques, anything that maybe people don't realize?
Oh, goodness. How long do we have?
Sure. maybe pick some highlights.
Well, I think let me think of three.
And you mentioned, go ahead.
Migrations. Okay. The cattle herding. Well, here's one. Texas Longhorn cattle. Mm-hmm. DNA from Fulani cattle in Western Africa. So that herding, not only the herding, but perhaps some of the cattle itself, actually may have, DNA probably does have African antecedents somewhere. So that's, okay. Anytime you hear Hook'em Horns,
yeah,
you got a little Fulani in there too.
Okay.
Yeah. So there's that. Let's see, what else? Watermelon.
Right.
Probably originated near the Namibian desert.
Mm-hmm.
And so, every summer everybody goes, watermelon, watermelon. I think people may recognize it as being African because of all of the seriously noxious and obnoxious images that we've seen of African Americans and watermelon. But the great irony is it actually did originate on the continent.
Mm-hmm. There's been some work done in that area recently. I remember reading something, about... coming up with the idea that it was in the southeastern part of the continent.
Yeah, right? So there's all of that. Because it appears in Egyptian, paintings and tomb paintings.
Right.
So, you see it everywhere, but that's it. Most folks forget coffee, Ethiopian Highlands.
Right.
Everybody's
right.
Running to Starbucks. Guess what? Starbucks, PJs, all of y'all, it's African.
Mm-hmm.
Coca-Cola, cola nuts, part of the original recipe, African.
Mm-hmm.
What else? Okra, which in the Bantu languages are known as Kingombo,
mm-hmm.
and Uchingombo.
And
in French,
mm-hmm.
it's simply gombo. So guess where gumbo's from? You can talk about bouillabaisse all you want to, but there is no racas.
Mm-hmm. You just anticipated what my question was, because that's a great New Orleans example, right?
Exactly. But everybody, for many, many years, people would say, related to bouillabaisse, and it's this and it's that. And there's been a kind of, whitening of food history in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly, it's a 20th century whitening in some cases. Gayarré, who was a writer here in the 19th century, had a quote that I put in some book, which was, the Negro is a born cook. It was just like, people have stereotypes today about African Americans and sports, basketball, mm-hmm. we own it. Let's just mm-hmm. fess up, we own it. But back in the 19th century, people were thinking cooking. We owned it. We owned it. It was acknowledged. People had no question of acknowledging the hand of the pot and the Africanity of that hand. Possibly not the Africanity, but the fact that it was a person of color, a black person.
Mm-hmm.
So that was interesting right there. And that's one of the things that changed between the 19th and the 20th centuries.
Okay. And would you elaborate on that? How did it
change? I'm actually not sure. It's not something I've ever really gone into depth of, and really was only thinking about it pretty much as it was drop-loading from brain to mouth right now.
Okay.
So
I don't want to create more work for you.
I'll have to come back.
Okay, fair enough. What about some of the technological? Because I think when we talk about cooking technology, there's some significant influence and contribution there.
Well, Jefferson Thomas had an enslaved chef.
Mm-hmm.
James Hemings, who was Sally Hemings' brother, who actually went to France, was apprenticed to the highest level of, the noblesse de la robe. So folks who were related to the king, and he was cooking in their kitchens as an apprentice. And he comes back to the States. He brings the notion of a stew-hole stove. That's a potager. That's the stove that you've got in the Grima house. So okay. He brings that idea back. It allows for very much more accurate cooking because you're not just doing open hearth cooking. So you can regulate. You can do all sorts of things. Copper pots he brings as well. So that finesse of cooking. He's also one of the first people that we see using ice cream. And arguably French fries.
I didn't know that. Okay.
The fun one is mac and cheese.
Oh, right. Okay.
So all of that goes back to Hemmings.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I had no idea about the mac and cheese either. And we were talking about, Jessica, about how we have so many festivals in New Orleans before we went on.
Right.
Now we have one of those, too.
Mac and cheese festival.
But I think we need to get them the real story.
Put a picture of Hemmings up.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, somewhere. Yeah. But equally, Jack Daniels.
Thank you. That's a good one, too, that I was going to ask you about.
Yeah. Jack Daniels got his know-how in many ways from Nearest Green,
yep.
Who was the distiller at the at a distillery where Daniels was apprenticing.
Mm-hmm.
So they were kind of apprenticing together, and then Nearest and Jack left, and voila, Jack Daniels. We're just discovering things. That's the thing that is so fascinating and so interesting about working with African-American food culture right now at this particular point in time is there's still much to be discovered. So the Nearest Green thing we found out less than 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that there are all of those things that are still, you know, it's like, oh my goodness, really? This, that? Oh, who knew? You know, and it's that kind of thing.
Do you, in that regard, and maybe using that story or any other, obviously, it takes good historical research to figure these things out, but then there's
also... Well, sometimes
also...
it just takes an accident, or it takes looking at a page and going, wait a minute, who is that?
Thank you, because that's actually what I was going to say, is that I think when we're talking about the whitening of and whitewashing of the history that we're talking about here, is it sometimes right in front of our face, but the story was told so differently that we just assume it's the truth
Absolutely.
And move forward? Or
Absolutely,
move on?
Or people don't question.
Right.
And so sometimes from the lack of questioning, it's just like, well, wait, now let me ask that question. Oh, that's the answer. And it's a completely different answer from what might have been anticipated.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's, you know, incumbent upon people to go back and do the work and find out what the real answer is.
And do that heavy lifting.
Yeah.
Right. And the Uncle Dearest brand has come out. Are you familiar with that particular bourbon?
No.
So there was a woman, and I should get this straight, but there's a woman who started a brand, not a distillery, that was meant to honor the tradition of Nearest Green.
Nearest Green. Well, he has descendants who yes. are working with Daniels, I believe, or
I think
in
so.
Some way. So I'm not sure. I'm not up on it. So when I'm not up on things, it behooves me to shut up.
Fair enough, and I'll do the exact same.
There you go.
The story, but that's a very interesting one. So when we talk about New Orleans, Jessica, then we do, nothing happens in a vacuum, right? So we talk about who gets credit for what or who doesn't get credit for what. You mentioned something about bouillabaisse. I think we need to understand that things don't happen in a vacuum. Influences and people bring things. Is it also fair to say that people bring what's familiar with them? And are they, you know, their technology, their knowledge, but are they also looking for a taste of home? Is that fair when people bring things also?
Well, I think absolutely. I think if you look at the food ways, to use that term, of anywhere, they are definitely influenced and inflected by the people who were there and where those folks came from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, red gravy down here,
mm-hmm.
you know, has a reason. It comes out of a history. It has its own genesis. It is something that connects people with their past. And I think so many foods do. Now, the connection with their past may be a little, I don't know, murkier or harder to unravel in the case of people who had been enslaved, because there's that dropping, if you will, of a stitch or two or more. But it's about how to go back and reclaim them and find them. In Ghana, they do cymbals. They cut calabashes and make prints using the cut calabash designs. And one of the prints that they use is something called Sankofa, S-A-N-K-O-F-A. And Sankofa is simply a variant, if you will, or another way of focusing the whole idea of Janus. You have to look back to know where you're going.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I think that that's part of what happens. You have to look back to know where you're going, and a lot of the looking back in terms of people who came out of enslavement is harder to get through. People sort of say, well, do you have, you know, your grandmother's recipes? And it's like, not really. No. And she certainly didn't have her grandmother's recipes, mm-hmm. because at some point there were no little printed cards, because just the act of reading was not allowed.
Mm-hmm.
So if you could read, you certainly probably weren't telling too many people, and you more than likely weren't writing down recipes.
Recipes. You had other things to
other fish to fry, as
right.
it were.
Right. Well, let's do this, Jessica. Let's take a little break here on the show, and we're going to come right back and talk a little more. Back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening in, friends, this week. And we are going to bring you a little bit of important information that you need to know. Amanda McMillan, who is the programming manager at the Historic New Orleans Collection, is here. And Amanda, let us know a little bit about HNOC and why people need to visit and check it out.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, we want everyone to come and visit us. So the Historic New Orleans Collection is a history museum located here in the French Quarter. We are also a research center. We have researchers come in from all over the world to come in and do research about the history of New Orleans. And we're also a publisher. We publish books every year about different topics. We have a musician's biography series, and we have an arts biography series, and just general topics about New Orleans history. So we do a lot here. And we're here in the French Quarter. We just opened a brand new exhibition facility that we're so excited about at 520 Royal Street. And you can visit our other museum facility right across the street. So they're right across the street from each other. You can go back and forth. Admission is free. And so I always tell people, like, if you're in the area, just stop on by. Just walk in for half hour if you have time. You know, just it's free. You can come back as many times as you want.
Right, right. And,
yeah.
And people can join, which we want to encourage people to
absolutely.
Do as well,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely, yeah. Our members support all of the programming that we do throughout the year, which is what I'm involved in. So that's how I got to work with Dr. Harris. We do lectures, film screenings, concerts. We do the culinary symposium every year, a history symposium. We have a lot going on, and our members are a huge part of being able to support those programming. And so, yeah, we have a lot going on.
It's a great place to visit, and I always want to encourage people, Amanda, as you know, that if you live here and you haven't been there, shame on you, because you live here and you need to know about where you live. And
yes.
Secondly, if you're coming to visit and you're a fan of New Orleans, which, as we know, most people who do come to visit
yes.
are here for the culture, this is a touchstone place from which to learn.
Absolutely. We want people, when they come to New Orleans, if you want to know about the French Quarter, we have a whole exhibit just on the history of the French Quarter. So come on down, make it your first stop so you get to understand where you are, why this French Quarter, this amazing historic district exists here in this country. And we have on-changing exhibitions. So you never know exactly where you're going to see, but it's a really great like first stop to get your base for your visit here
yeah,
to New Orleans.
Yeah, it's a great way to put it. Come here first and then then you will see things with different eyes.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
So music, there's all kinds of music stuff. There's mm-hmm. culinary stuff, which is what we're talking about here today,
yes.
of course.
Yes.
And architecture, and your collection is massive. So you guys are rotating things through
Absolutely.
All the time, right?
Yeah, we have changing exhibitions throughout the year. We're just about to open one at the end of November called Crescent City Sport, Stories of Courage and Change. So we're doing sports history, which is a little bit maybe not exactly what people think of when they think about history, but sports offer so much opportunity to kind of look at culture and how culture has changed. And sports, you know, influence all different aspects of our life and our city here. So we're so excited to present this exhibition.
Amanda, tell people where they can find HNOC online and social media and all that stuff.
Absolutely. You can find the Historic New Orleans Collection on Facebook and on Instagram. Instagram at visit_THNOC. We have a really great Instagram account. I always recommend it. We do great videos and lots of like kind of historic tidbits and look at objects in the collection, kind of behind the scenes looks. So it's a lot of fun. And you can also sign up for our newsletter too on our website, www.hnoc.org.
Great. Thank you very much. I really appreciate that. Please, friends, go visit the Historic New Orleans Collection. It is a fantastic place. Jessica, you mentioned you were looking for partnerships, and so that you just kind of said, hey, I should go check these folks out at HNOC. And...
Well, I'm obviously kind of a history buff. And I don't know when I wandered in. I mean, I've been coming to New Orleans for, multiple decades. Let's leave it at that. And it's just the most extraordinary place. Mm-hmm. I mean, anywhere else, it would be the go-to spot. It would not be a question. But the history galleries are just so incredible. And the research is ongoing. The Purchased Lives exhibit that they did about enslavement and New Orleans as the big slave market of the South was transformational for many people. And I'm sure that a lot of people who came learned things they didn't know. The new building has something that I deeply covet for any number of places, which is a table on which you can plot out walking tours the French Quarter. It's extraordinary. Or mm-hmm. the surrounding areas, and you can learn about the history. You can learn all of it. That table didn't exist, but the other things existed when I first came, and it was like, oh my goodness, if these people will pair with me, I'm really happy to pair with them. And so that's how it started. And then after I left Dillard, they sort of said, well, we still like you, so keep coming.
So come on, keep coming back.
Well, I'm tickled to death that I can keep coming. And I'm looking forward to lots of planning, and I always call Amanda McPhillan my co-conspirator.
Gotcha.
Yeah, yeah.
She's nodding over there.
Well,
we got about 2.5 minutes left, Jessica, before we have to close out the radio portion of the show. You're going to stick around for another shot with Nola Drinks for another segment. So, friends, if you're listening on the radio, go get the podcast because that's where the action is. But your latest publication is a memoir.
Yes.
And My Soul Looks Back. And so that... It's good. I'm always interested when people choose to write a memoir. That's got to be, you hit this particular wave in life, right? And you're ready to do it.
No.
Okay.
It was sort of random conversation with my editor and then the death of Maya Angelou. Mm-hmm. Because I had the great good fortune to be Dr. Angelou's friend mm-hmm. for more than 4 decades. So people always sort of raise an eyebrow. I think I raised my eyebrow mentally because that's the first time I've called her Dr. Angelou. I usually called her to her face Maya, which was something that would have indicated to anyone who knew us or certainly knew her and her trajectory that I'd known her for a long time. Mm-hmm. But so I had a kind of wonderfully charmed young adulthood where I was sort of, as I like to put it, the tail of the tail of the kite of the friendship that was the friendship between Maya Angelou and James Baldwin and Toni Morrison and any number of people like that I had the great good fortune to, be in their presence.
I was going to ask you about that in the podcast thing, but we'll get further into that. Do me a favor. Would you please tell people where they can connect with you online, find your publications?
Okay. Believe it or not, I actually have Instagram accounts. I don't necessarily post a lot, but at Dr. Dr. Jessica B. Harris or at AfriCooks, AfriCooks. And I have a website that I promise I'm going to upgrade, which is AfriCooks, AfriCooks.com.
Great. And people can easily find
And they can find all of the book titles there. They can find the occasional article. I promise there will be more. They can find, bio of me, and they can actually click on something and see what I look like.
Okay, great. Well, friends, what we're going to do here, we're going to close out the radio portion of the show. Thank you for listening in. Again, if you are listening on the radio, please go get the podcast. Visit NolaDrinks.com. You can find the Nola Drinks Show on all the major podcast platforms. Dr. Harris is going to stick around. We're going to chat a little further on another shot with Nola Drinks. But again, if you're listening on the radio, remember to be kind to one another, use your turn signal, and until next time, cheers, y'all.
said. All these saints and all these sinners will try to bend your ear. It don't matter who you're serving, we're all the same down here.
All right, everybody, up another shot with Noel Drinks. Thanks for sticking around, friends. Hope you are enjoying and finding this conversation with Dr. Jessica Harris as stimulating as I do. Going to bounce right back over to the Historic New Orleans Collection, their research facility on Charter Street, to chat with her a little bit further. We're going to talk about the importance of markets and a couple other things. And after that, I'll be back with my parting shot. Here we go. Yep, another shot with Noel Drinks, friends. Brian Diaz here with you. As always, thanks for listening in. And we are chatting with our guest, Dr. Jessica Harris. And Jessica, when we close out the radio portion of the show, you were talking a little bit about your upbringing and having spent time with Maya Angelou and Toni Morrison and James Baldwin. How did that come to be? I know that's a pretty big question, but this was
getting all in the business.
give whatever version you like.
Well, no, I ironically and certainly peculiarly in this day and age, when so many people change jobs almost by mandate every 5 years or so, I worked in the same place at varying degrees of the same job for 50 years. So I taught at Queens College in the SEEK program, SEEK program being a higher education opportunity program. And when I started out, that was my first job after college. And the gentleman who was the, I don't remember his exact title, but he was sort of the head of, teacher responsibility and such, was a man named Samuel Clemens Floyd III. And we became friendly and ultimately became partners, sort of friends. And I certainly didn't know it at the time that I met him, but certainly learned subsequently that he was James Baldwin's best friend. And so because I knew Sam, because I was Sam's friend, I ultimately ended up being sort of Sam's appendage, as it were, and then being able to, sort of be in the room. Okay. And, it was quite a room.
That sounds like quite a room.
It was an amazing room.
Well, thank you. I won't ask you any further about that.
I'll draw the veil of discretion in any case. Read the book.
There you go. Well, I was going to ask you actually about one of your other publications, High on the Hog, A Culinary Journey from Africa to America. Was that, and I was reading a bit from that, and we were talking about Maya Angelou. She wrote the foreword to the book. Mm-hmm. And it seems like kind of extrapolating, perhaps, from what she said, sort of a different work for you. Was that kind of a turning point for you in some fashion?
I think it was. As a writer, and particularly as somebody known for cookbooks, I don't cook from cookbooks, really. I find that I don't really follow recipes. I'm more of an intuitive cook. I, sort of may read 3 or 4 recipes and then decide what I'm going to do. Mm-hmm. so that writing recipe has never been my great joy, because my mind just doesn't work that way. So I'm more improvisational. And what happened was I noticed that in the cookbooks, the head notes, that would be the little commentary in front of the recipe, kept getting longer and longer and longer. And I had, and still have, a wonderful editor who sort of said, I think you need to write narrative. I think you can do this. I think that this is something, she said, I wouldn't necessarily say it to everybody, but I think you can. So that was what happened with High on the Hog. And so it is a culinary journey from Africa to America. And it is narrative. There are 10 recipes, and that's it. And the 10 recipes are either historic or recipes from other books. So it was like, no recipes. Yes. Okay. Then I had the same editor who was really good, and we were having dinner at some point after Maya's death, and I had been asked to do an article for the New York Times on cooking with Maya. And so as a result of that, she said, well, talk to me a little bit about that. And then in the course of the conversation, she said, I think that's your next book. So there's that. But I'm going back to recipe writing because I've, you know, in the process of speaking with the publisher about doing a new book, and it will be a cookbook, but it'll be recipe writing. And I'm going to perhaps collaborate with some friends on the recipes, so that'll be fun.
Oh, okay, great. Yeah. And it'll be more of a straight sort of cookbook?
I don't believe in doing anything. It'll be a straight
cookbook. Okay, fair enough.
It'll be a cookbook inflected in my, manner.
Gotcha, fair enough. And when do we have a? I know it can be difficult, but do you have a goal for that?
Probably not sure. It'd probably be 2021 at some point.
Okay. Another book that I wanted to actually have you talk about, because this is the Nola Drink Show, so mm-hmm. we do talk about drinking from time
to
time.
So we're going to rum drinks.
Yeah, so yeah, rum drinks, 50 Caribbean cocktails from Cuba Libre to the Rum Daisy. What prompted
Needless
you to want to do
say
that?
That title was done by a committee.
right.
I've always been fascinated. I've spent a lot of my time traveling to the Caribbean. I've been to certainly all of the major islands, and mm-hmm. I've been to Bekwe. I've been to Carriacou. You know, I've been to places that folks don't even know exist. Mm-hmm. And I also spent 12 years doing consulting for an all-inclusive hotel in Barbados that no longer exists. It was called Almond Resorts. And in the course of that, started really getting fascinated by sugarcane culture, which is, you know, perfect New Orleans tie-in again, mm-hmm. because this is, you know, this is the decadence and the end, if you will, of sugarcane that starts in Barbados in 1667 or something
right
like
about,
that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, that fascination with cane, with culture, of course, cane brought with it enslavement. And so it's all of those things that I like to research sort of rolled up into one neat little thing. Mm-hmm. And in this case, the thing was rum. And I have been known to have a glass or two of rum and like particular rums. I'm not, I'm not an expert by any stretch of the imagination, but know what I like. Mm-hmm. And sort of convince some folks that I knew enough to write a book about it. So
great.
That's how that happened.
Was that also? There were drink recipes in that book.
Oh yeah,
right?
Yeah. There are 50 drink recipes. That title does not lie.
The committee was accurate.
The committee was accurate.
Right. That's a great maybe a show for another time, because talking about the rum trade and the sugarcane trade is also an interesting vehicle to tell the history of the New World.
Exactly.
Let me ask you one last question before I know you got to scoot. You know, this is kind of a big question, so we don't have to go too far down this road. Talking about, I think, the variation and the importance of markets with food and culinary tradition. I was reading something also from High on the Hog, and you were talking about, I believe it was your first visit to West Africa. Mm-hmm. And Dakar, was it?
I think the opening chapter is actually on Benin, and it's about the Dantokba.
Okay. Yeah.
And with great irony, I can say that I was actually at the Dantokba 2.5 weeks ago.
Oh, wow.
So
okay.
I was in Benin at the Tokba. And it is the most amazing thing. I mean, I think that people don't understand the importance of markets. We know the French market. We get a sense of what it has become, but I don't think we have a sense of what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we have a sense of what it was compared to some of the markets in West Africa today. I can't even talk about the Tokpa. It covers acres. I think it's the second largest outdoor market on the African continent.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And it's got everything from fabric and clothing all the way through butchers, all the way through gasoline, which they sell rather frighteningly in demijohns, and plastic, you know, liter bottles. Mm-hmm. And there's another section where you can get cooked food. There's a section where you can get spices. There's another section where you can buy things that you might need for a voodoo ceremony. They've got it all, and it's there. But it's also, markets are, it's where we come together. Mm-hmm. That Greek word, agora, you know, and the whole idea of the marketplace, it's where the news gets shared, it's where the commerce goes on, it's where all of those things come together. I love markets.
Thank you for saying that, and that's the reason why I asked that question. It almost reminds me of why you need to visit the HNOC when you come here, is visiting a market, because they are so diverse in what they offer and the interactions, the dynamics, the people. It's, to me, it's how you learn about a culture. It's one of the best places to go right out of the gate.
Absolutely.
And some of the ones that I've seen, you reminded me of one. I lived in Busan in South Korea for a year, and I lived right by the largest outdoor market in Busan, which I think was the largest one in the country. And it was square miles large.
Yeah.
And strolling through is very eye-opening and very educational. And like we talk about, where, and this was a key point that, thank you for saying this, how information is transmitted in markets. It actually reminds me, and maybe you would share an opinion on this as well, one of my favorite things when we talk about drinking culture in New Orleans, and that is part of our culture, I think we all know that, is that information is transmitted in bars here.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think markets, it's that kind of shared concept as well.
And bars are very much the neighborhood thing, and yep. Markets are the neighborhood thing, except
right.
There is always that sort of Uber market where you can find everyone. I don't know that there is the Uber bar. There's still neighborhood. That would
right.
be an interesting place, the
yeah.
bar where all things are exchanged. That could be frightening.
That could be frightening. Great. Well, thank you very much. Jessica, will you run down one more time the Instagram account and your,
okay,
and your websites, please?
Instagram account is Dr. Dr. Jessica B. Harris. And the second one is at AfriCooks, AfriCooks. And the website is AfriCooks.com. But I'm going to add one little thing
Please.
To it that I didn't say on the radio show, which is, and I've done some podcasts.
Oh, yeah, sure. Okay.
You know, if you're a podcast listener, mine are music, food, memoir, and travel. So each podcast is a different place. And you can go on whatever the podcast
the different platforms,
mm-hmm. and look for Jessica B. Harris, look for my face, and have a listen.
Great. Jessica, thank you very much for your time. It was a pleasure chatting with you
thank
today.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. And thank you, Amanda.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Friends, we're going to take a brief musical interlude on the Noah Drink Show, and I'll be back with my parting shot. All right, everybody. Hey, thanks for listening into the show this week, friends. I do appreciate it as always. I mentioned this at the top of the show. Next week's show is going to be a good one. We are over at the newly opened Sazerac House Museum there on the corner of Canal and Magazine Street, right there just outside the French Quarter, if you're not familiar with the area. And a really interesting place. We're talking with the general manager there, as well as the distillery supervisor. They're doing some on-site distilling and making of Sazerac rye whiskey, as well as Peychaud's bitters, and are going to gear up, probably do a few other things. And it's a whole interactive museum and presentation and tasting stations and all kinds of cool stuff. So a really cool interview that we have coming up for you there. We're going to taste through some different things that they have, including a new line of rum that they have coming out. Well, here's our parting shot, friends. Dr. Jessica Harris, very interesting guest, very interesting person, as I'm sure that you gathered. It was truly an honor to have her on. And one of the things that we touched on, which I think is very interesting and very important to highlight here, this sort of idea of hiding in plain sight. And if I remember correctly, when we were talking about, we touched on Nearest Green, who really was the first distiller for Jack Daniel's. And he was an African-American gentleman. And we would see pictures of him in photos and things. But, you know, of course, that's not the way these stories work with branding and at the time and so on and so forth. And now in very, very recent years, Jack Daniel's has finally acknowledged Nearest Green's role in their history and getting things rolling at Jack Daniel's with the bourbon that everybody drinks today. Right.
And I think, as Dr. Harris said, you know, we see these photos and, you know, things can be hiding in plain sight. And sometimes we have to ask these questions. Certainly there is the whitewashing or the whitening of history that has gone on forever in the United States. And I think people then tend to just not ask questions and take certain things for granted, or because of the history of enslavement and all of the dynamics that came with that, a lot of records were lost. It's harder to find the true stories behind certain things, but with good research and digging and, again, asking the questions we need to ask, sometimes these things can come to light. Now, I think this really plays out considerably in New Orleans. It's a complex place. It can be a frustrating and even a maddening place at times, frankly. It's a complex blend of peoples, cultures, economic realities, ecological truths, and really so much more. For all the great food, great music, architecture, hospitality, the culture, and the forward thinking that we have here in some circles, there is also poverty, there is racism, there is bigotry, there is fear of the other, there is cultural appropriation, and there is backward thinking. There is progress, but yet there is digression. There is change, and yet there is stasis. It's a landscape that at times that can welcome new ideas, but also at times, and maybe even rightfully so, bristle firmly against them. Now, I'm not trying to say that New Orleans has a monopoly on all that, and it's the only place in the world that demonstrate those dynamics or sets of realities and how they interact with each other, but I would argue that few places have such a unique combination of factors. You know, friends, I almost always find doing the show very rewarding because I learn something. That's one of the main reasons why I do it. And often there's something, you know, I learned something about New Orleans. I also learned something about all kinds of other things. And the guests that come on the show so often, like Dr. Harris, are so fascinating and stimulating, bringing a rich experience and a different viewpoint. They help me, and they hopefully help you see things that are not always apparent, getting us to ask those questions, to find out the truth and the real story. I think a place like the Historic New Orleans collection, can help that out a lot too. I said that at the top of the show, and we touched on it during the interview. It's a place that you should go visit, whether you live here or if you're coming to see us here in New Orleans. Utilizing a great resource like the Historic New Orleans Collection and really the many others that are out there and available to you. And hopefully, friends, you find the show to be one of those resources or assets. These things can unlock doors and reveal things about this complex, frustrating, maddening, yet joyous, enriching, wonderful place that we call New Orleans. And if you go to some place like the Historic New Orleans Collection, hopefully from listening to our show and any of these number of these other things that help you interpret out there, help you interpret things and see things, I guarantee you will discover much, much more that is hiding in plain sight. Friends, that's our parting shot. Here's to you.